Good morning. I'm speaking with Michael Clare, Five College Professor Emeritus of Peace and World Security Studies, who serves on the board of the Arms Control Association and advises other organizations in the field. Clare has written widely on U.S. military policy, international peace and security affairs, the global arms trade, and global resource politics in many books. His latest book, All Hell Breaking Loose: The Pentagon's Perspective on Climate Change. His articles appear in publications including Arms Control Today, Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, Current History, Foreign Affairs, The Nation, Scientific American, and Technology Review. Well, welcome, Michael Clare. It's great to have you back on KABU.
Hi.
It's been about a decade, but you used to be a frequent guest with Bill Resnick and Per Fahlgren, and we always appreciate your insights about the military-industrial complex.
It's a delight to be back.
Well, you're recently writing about a new military-industrial complex emerging out of Silicon Valley. Tell us about the difference between the old and the new military-industrial complexes.
So the old military-industrial complex, or what we used to call the military-industrial complex, by the way, that's a term that was originally coined by President Dwight Eisenhower in his farewell speech to the nation. He warned about the growing influence of a military-industrial complex and its growing power. And what we usually mean by that is the conglomeration of a half dozen or so giant corporations, Raytheon, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and a half a dozen others that produce most of the weapons acquired by the US military in large, multi-billion dollar, multi-year contracts that involve industrial production all over the United States. And these companies have enormous political influence in Washington. They contribute a lot to the campaign spending of key members of Congress. So they're well entrenched in the American political scene.
So, what is new about this complex emerging out of Silicon Valley?
A number of things are different. These companies are not large industrial combines. They derive their technology from artificial intelligence. So you have to begin with that, with AI as their principal raw material. It's not steel and iron and large industrial factories producing heavy metal objects like airplanes and tanks. They produce algorithms and, at best, drone weapons, robotic weapons. So they don't have the large industrial conglomerations that the old MIC, military industrial complex, has. And most of their work is very secretive and is produced by a half a dozen or so companies, many of them startups. I should say more than half a dozen because more keep sprouting up all the time. But there are some that stand out, like Anduril and Palantir, that have been garnering a lot of contracts lately from the Department of Defense. But there's more that's distinctive about them than that. But it begins with their focus on artificial intelligence and its use in weapons. And it's an area that the Department of Defense is unfamiliar with and is so trusting these companies a lot more than it would other companies.
Now, you've noted that there's likely to be political turbulence between the old corporate welfare giants like Boeing and Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, which have for so many decades had a grip on Congress. In fact, Congress routinely grants more money to the Pentagon than the Pentagon requests. And that there's likely to be competition between them and the tech startups. Or do you think we'll just see more and more of the public resources siphoned from the Treasury to support both of these?
So that's a question that, we'll discover more about in the coming months as President Trump issues his first budget requests. Those won't materialize for several months now, how the money is going to be spent. But the Trump administration has indicated in a number of public statements that it favors more artificial intelligence, more drones, more robotics, and less of the old industrial style weaponry. So even if the defense budget remains the same or increases some, as is likely, more of the money is going to be shunted, I believe, from older weapon systems to these new artificial intelligence directed weapons.
Well, hasn't Trump even stated on multiple occasions that he plans to dump $500 billion into AI development? And this is even as China has demonstrated that AI can be developed more cheaply and using less energy. So, I mean, how much of this is just shoveling billions of dollars to his fellow billionaire corporate friends?
That's an interesting question. It's a little bit hard to distinguish between those two because he certainly is favoring his friends in this universe of the Silicon Valley-based companies. Remember that Elon Musk is a major defense contractor. Turned out he gets $38 billion in contracts with the Department of Defense, mainly for space-related work. So he is a major defense contractor as well in this new era. But you have to also look at J.D. Vance, the vice president. J.D. Vance was an acolyte of Peter Thiel, who is a Silicon Valley investor and an activist who is behind this push to focus on artificial intelligence and robotics as the way to go rather than the old military-industrial complex. Peter Thiel is the head of Palantir, one of the leading AI defense contractors. So you have direct links between the president's team, J.D. Vance, and this new military-industrial complex in Silicon Valley.
What about the fact that China has demonstrated that this technology can be developed more cheaply, given the just bloated Pentagon budgets that we've seen over the decades? Is that likely to affect the Trump administration's so-called concern about budget savings and pressuring these tech companies to utilize this less expensive methods of developing AI?
So this is a debate within the AI community that can be very esoteric at times. And the people who participate in this debate speak in coded language. You know, they presume that you have an advanced degree in computer science even to participate in the conversation. But what they argue is that dominance in the 21st century, global dominance will require the most advanced artificial intelligence algorithms possible, and that these more advanced algorithms will require this excessive spending that President Trump favors and J.D. Vance and Elon Musk favor. That only by spending this money and developing the more advanced technologies than even the Chinese have demonstrated is the way to ensure US political and military dominance in the 21st century. And this is an ideology with them, an ethos, if you will. And it has captivated the White House. So it doesn't matter that China claims, or some companies in China claim they've found a cheaper way to do it. That doesn't affect this ethos about technological supremacy.
And you've noted that throughout the American national security establishment, there is this fixation on doing what it takes to become globally dominant through this use of AI and fully autonomous weapons.
Absolutely. I think you're going to hear a lot more of this ideology being spoken. By the way, this is closely connected to Trump's pursuit of critical minerals, rare earths, and other critical minerals in Canada, especially, and also Greenland and Ukraine. He's expected to push for Trump, that is, seeks to gain control over Greenland, which has a lot of these specialized minerals, to sign agreements with Ukraine to get access to the minerals there as a price of continued U.S. support. And he claims that Canada should become a part of the United States, particularly to exploit Canada's reserves of these specialized minerals that are crucial for the AI-powered military complex.
And that seems to be a difference in Trump's military-industrial complex from previous administrations, this very outright imperialist effort to not only dominate the world as this global superpower, but also to kind of revive this 19th century mentality of just basically colonizing the world in terms of mining resources.
Exactly. I think that all of this fits together in a pattern of 19th century colonial imperialism, which was precisely intended to extract vital materials from colonized countries, whether it was iron ore or copper or oil, or earlier than that, gold and silver. That is what has driven imperial conquest for centuries, and something that we thought had become relegated to history. But this is something that the Trump administration, and Trump in particular, has revived with a vengeance. And it is part of a plan, I think, to ensure permanent U.S. global dominance.
Well, with the accelerated investments into research and development around semi-autonomous and unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, what does this mean for the world? I mean, I think we've had a glimpse of the kind of horrific damage that these drones can do as Israel has used them in Gaza and Lebanon. But what are some other dangers of this kind of accelerated use of drone warfare?
My biggest fear, and I'm speaking here in my capacity as a senior research fellow at the Arms Control Association, my biggest fear is that more advanced drones that the Defense Department is talking about and these new Silicon Valley companies are proposing to build will be used in a future conflict with, say, Russia or China, and are designed to incapacitate enemy capabilities in a way that I think increases the risk of nuclear escalation, because these weapons will be used in drone swarms. Picture hundreds or even thousands of autonomous weapons being sent without human control to attack Chinese facilities in the event of a conflict over Taiwan, say, that could be critical to China's defense against nuclear first strike. And in those conditions, you could have very rapid, unintended or not, escalation to the use of nuclear weapons.
And you have concluded that the US military is and the Trump administration are totally fixated on preparing for a war with China, and that this new nuclear arms race has had little opposition or attention, as opposed to the anti-nuke movement of the 1990s, which was fairly successful. I mean, what's been happening recently about the acceleration of nuclear stockpiles?
Oh, this is a sad story to discuss because we've largely turned our attention away from nuclear weapons affairs now for understandable reasons. So many of us have been focused on the threat of climate change, which has seemed so omnipresent, and concern about COVID and other possible pandemics, which we still have to worry about. So it's easy to understand how people lost track of nuclear developments. But the fact is that in the past 10 years, there's been an acceleration of nuclear weapons developments by all three major nuclear powers, China, the US, and Russia. All three are modernizing their nuclear forces. and installing more capable weapons that might increase the incentives for a nuclear first strike in the case of a crisis. And China, I think, out of fear of being attacked by the United States in a nuclear first strike, is doubling or tripling the size of its own nuclear stockpile and expanding its nuclear capabilities. And this, of course, is adding to pressure in Washington, especially by the Republicans, to increase the U.S. nuclear stockpile. And we have a very significant milestone coming up a year from now. On February 5th, 2026, the last remaining nuclear arms control agreement, the New START treaty, will expire unless there is a concerted effort by the U.S. and Russia. It's a U.S.-Russia agreement to continue that, which sets limits on the number of deployed nuclear weapons on both sides. And if that expires without anything new to replace it, I think you're going to see an arms race worse than anything we've seen before, even in the 1960s, because now you have three actors, not two, pursuing nuclear weapons. And these are weapons that are more designed for actual war fighting purposes.
And it seems to me this is tied up with the expansion of the military's utilization of AI and autonomy at any cost. You know, there's that race as well as this new nuclear arms race. And what is the pushback? Of course, we don't see any pushback or much pushback in the United States, but around the world, what is the pushback against this nuclear arms race and race for drone warfare?
Well, now I don't see any pushback around nuclear rearmament anywhere, to tell you the truth. There are figures in Congress. I just spoke to some of them. There is a caucus in the House and the Senate of members concerned about the risks of nuclear war. So there is some concern, but not enough to stop the ongoing rush to expand nuclear arsenals. So what we need is more public pressure. And I do see hopeful evidence of that. After long silence, there are groups forming. I think of the Back from the Brink group, which is active in many parts of the country to try to stop this race. But we're going to need a lot more public pressure if we're to have any effect.
Well, Michael Clare, you've been an activist for many decades in trying to rein in the national security state, and very few people know how the system works. But given the enormous power of the system, can you recommend where advocates can best apply pressure? What can people do to limit the military-industrial complex and redirect this enormous wealth, supporting it to more socially useful projects?
There are organizations, grassroots organizations, that are trying to build constituent pressure on Congress to hold the line on military spending. I recommend learning about supporting the Friends Committee on National Legislation, the FCNL, which does heroic work in this field. Like I say, you can look up Back from the Brink. Their website is nonuclearwar.org. And there are other efforts underway like that. That's one area. I should mention that there is an international drive to ban the deployment of autonomous weapons that are not under human control, led by the Campaign to Stop Killer Robots. And they've done a very good job internationally to lobby diplomats at the UN and other international fora to adopt a ban like that. And hopefully that's going to come up at the UN General Assembly next year.
Well, those are good recommendations. And I also want to recommend to listeners that they check out the video that you created and narrated on the Security in Context website. It's a great 10-minute short overview of the national security establishment, and it clearly lays out the many, many layers: the Department of Defense, U.S. bases, military divisions, the foreign policy establishment or the blob, military contractors and how this powerful ecosystem operates. So that will be useful to many people, and we'll post a link to it on the Old Mole Variety Hour KBOO website. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael Clare. We really appreciate all the work that you do.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking with you.